But that is not the case in literature from ancient India. Fight intensely, they hunt intensely, and they love intensely, becoming the first such state in Indian history. So who is this Vedavyasa? There is a connection. Let me explain. What is Mahabharata? Who is it about? Why is it considered the greatest story ever told, and how is it relevant to this day? If you're curious about these questions, you've come to the right place. Namaste. Hello everyone. This is Stories of India Retold, and today we're talking all about Mahabharata. Many millennia ago, there was a boy named Krishnadvaipayana. Krishna because he was dark-skinned, and Dvaipayana because he was born on an island. He lived on this island with his mother Satyavati, who was the daughter of the chief of the local fishermen tribe. His father was a sage named Parashara, who was a well-learned sage, and he was learned in the Veda. Dvaipayana was a bright boy, and like his father, he too wanted to learn the Veda. And so when he was of an age, he left the island to pursue his studies. Not only did he study the Veda, but he also compiled it and arranged it into four different books, a system that is followed to this day. Now you might be thinking, but this is about Mahabharata, so why are we talking about the Veda? There is a connection. Let me explain. The Veda is a text from ancient India, and it was very important to the people during the Vedic times, so much so that they considered it to be divine knowledge passed down from Brahma, the creator himself. Dvaipayana thought about the fact that the profound truths and messages found in the Veda are neither easily understood nor were they easy to access. You see, the Veda was composed in Sanskrit, a language that was not widely spoken, and it was transmitted to a select group of people who had to learn it via precise oral repetition so that it would be passed down through generations unchanged. And the unchanged part here was really important because they wanted to make sure to maintain the integrity of the text. So as you can see, not really easy to access. But Dvaipayana had a plan. Dvaipayana wrote a poem about a family belonging to the Kuru dynasty, particularly about the dynastic politics between the cousins Kauravas and Pandavas. And in this story, he weaved the messages from the Veda, making it both easier to understand and easy to access. Because these stories are about a royal family that actually existed, this text is part of the Itihasa literature of ancient India. Itihasa meaning so it happened. And it is part of the record of contemporary history of the time. Compare this with, say, the Puranas, which contain stories from the remote past. That is one way to classify the text. Another way to classify literature from ancient India is they could be either Smriti text or Shruti text. Shruti means that which is heard. And these are texts which are transmitted via precise oral repetition like the Veda or the Upanishads. These texts are composed in Sanskrit and they contain divine revelations. Texts which took these divine revelations and talked about them and explained them and were geared more towards the masses were written down to be transmitted. They were called Smriti text. Smriti means that which is remembered. And Mahabharata is a Smriti text. We know that Mahabharata is an epic, and the stories in the Mahabharata are sometimes referred to as myths. But according to ancient Indian literary tradition, it is called Itihasa or history. So which is it? That's a difficult question to answer. So what is a myth? A myth is an oral repository of stories belonging to a group of people. They contain stories about creation, civilization, and their heroes. It's a social practice. Myth may not be true at all, and it has no structure, nor does it have any pattern. It has an element of magic to it. You know, there are stories about gods, demigods, magical creatures, and their interactions with the human. An epic, on the other hand, is an established literary genre. It has a structure, a pattern, and it is based on true historic events. In the Western literary world, you can make a distinction of, say, for example, the Odyssey is an epic and the Greek myths are myths. But that is not the case in literature from ancient India. You can't make that kind of a distinction. For example, in the case of the Mahabharata, you will see stories about gods, demigods, magical creatures. You'll also see stories about civilization and creation. And along with it, you will see stories about a dynasty, its genealogy, its history, religion, politics, spirituality, metaphysics, and so on and so forth. So sometimes it is difficult to even figure out what is fiction and what is not. Not only that, remember Dwaipayana included the wisdom from the four Vedas in these stories. And so the Mahabharata is sometimes referred to as the fifth Veda. This gives it a sacred status. And so people can sometimes be very sentimental about these stories, and different people have different approaches and ideas about these stories. So it becomes really difficult to put this story in a box and call it an epic or a myth or part of history, because it is all of that and more. Dwaipayana composed the Mahabharata between 8th to 9th century BCE. He worked on it for a period of 3 years. He wrote 60 chapters, and with 8,800 shlokas or couplets, the book was called the Jaya or Victory. After its completion, Dwaipayana passed down the stories to his students. He passed part of it down to his student, a Sauti or bard named Vaishampayana. Other Sautis are mentioned in the Mahabharata. Some of them are Romaharshana and his son Ugrashrava, and also Vyasa's son Sukha. Now, these narrators and others would retell the stories in various settings, like temples, religious gatherings, social gatherings, and other places. And not only that, these stories were told in different art forms like paintings, songs, and dance. And in this way, the story spread far and wide. And with each retelling, it took on a new form. Narrators began to pad the story with details about genealogy, friends, family, allies, enemies, and great people. After some time had passed, the book began to be called Vijaya. And when it had about 24,000 shlokas, the book was called the Bharata, as the book contained stories belonging to the people of the clan Bharata. As time passed, with more and more retellings, more and more details began to be added to the Bharata. Details about geography, history, politics, spirituality, metaphysics, and so much more were added. With about 90,000 shlokas, the book was now called the Mahabharata, the great epic of the people belonging to the Bharata clan. Now, this process happened over a period of 1,000 years, and the story we know and love was completed in 4th century AD. Even after that time, the Mahabharata continued to spread and it continued to evolve. It has also been translated to many other languages like Odia, Kannada, Tamil, Telugu, and other languages. And each time the author would add their own flair. And so you can imagine it has gone through a few changes. And speaking of adding their own flair, there are a couple of interesting things that I'd like to note. Have you ever seen an illustration depicting a scene from the Mahabharata and wondered why they're wearing the clothes that they're wearing. Like this one, for example. If you're not watching this on video, this is an illustration depicting a scene from the Mahabharata, and in it, the characters are wearing Islamic style attire, which we know cannot be true during that time, right? So what happened is the Mughal king Akbar had the Mahabharata translated to Persian, and this book was called Razamnama, or the Book of War, and it is an illustrated book. This book was written for the Persians by the Persians, which is why you see the characters wearing the clothes that they're wearing. Makes sense, right? Another really interesting version of the Mahabharata belongs to the people of the tribe Bhil, which is an ancient Indian tribe. Their version is different than, let's call it, the standard version. It is transmitted orally, and it is a collection of stories rather than one continuous narrative that you would find in the standard version. And their stories are reflective of what is important to the people of the tribe. For example, the character Vasuki, who belonged to the Naga tribe, is a more prominent hero than, say, even the Pandavas. Also, themes of kingdom, statehood, and caste are not present in their stories because these themes are not important to the people of the tribe. Isn't that fascinating? I absolutely love it. So as you can see, there have been many versions, translations, and editions of the Mahabharata. Some are just different versions. Some are edited to make them more child-friendly. Some are biased, and some unfortunately can have certain motivations or agendas. And so in the midst of all of this, to find a version that is standardized, I think, is the best way to approach the story. Not that there is anything wrong with somebody's version or somebody's interpretation, but for me personally, I wanted to read the original version of the Mahabharata first so that I can make my mind about the interpretations and other translations. In the year 1919, BORI, short for Bhandarkar Oriental Research Institute, based in Pune in India, undertook the mammoth task of putting together a critical edition of Mahabharata. Over a period of 5 decades, scholars pored over 1,259 manuscripts from all over. In the year 1966, the critical edition of Mahabharata by BORI was released. BORI's critical edition weeds out the shlokas or couplets that the scholars believed may have been later additions, and by later I mean after 4th century AD, and it presents us with an edition of the Mahabharata which possibly can be the closest to what the original may have been. This is how the book is structured. The Mahabharata is made up of different episodes or parvas. There are 2 ways to classify them, and depending on the type of classification, you can have either 98 parvas or 18 parvas. Each parva is made up of chapters or adhyayas. In all, there are 2,113 adhyayas, and each adhyaya is made up of shlokas or couplets. And in total, there are 90,000 shlokas. The complete and original text consists of approximately 2 million words. And what you see in the book when you read this story is that a character in this story itself becomes a narrative of a second story within the first story itself. This type of narrative technique is called the story within the story, or embedded narrative. And there are many such layers of stories within stories, and this is called nested stories. I'm mainly reading the Mahabharata, complete and unabridged, translated by author Bibek Debroy. It is based on the critical edition of Mahabharata published by Bori. It is a set of 10 books, a lot to go through, but I've really been enjoying reading it. So if anyone is looking to read a translation of Mahabharata, I would highly, highly recommend this book. Let's look at the story of the Mahabharata more closely. It can be summarized in a quote from the text itself. It goes like this. Whatever is found here on dharma, artha, kama, and moksha may be found elsewhere, but whatever is not found in it cannot be found anywhere else. Basically, what they're saying is Mahabharata is about everything. The Mahabharata begins with the retelling of this epic by a sauti or bard to the sages and kings gathered for a snake sacrifice organized by King Janamejaya, who is a descendant of the Pandavas. The epic starts with the history and genealogy of the kings and princes of the Kuru dynasty. Successive chapters tell the story of Kauravas and Pandavas, their birth, their relationship, the dynastic politics, the Kurukshetra war and aftermath, and it ends with the death of the Pandavas and their entry into the spiritual world. While telling the story of the beginning and evolution of the Kuru dynasty, the bard tells many interesting love stories about the kings and princes. The stories about how the kings met their future wives and the stories about the birth of the princes. When I think about it, I find that love is a significant theme in the Mahabharata. Apart from the love stories that we get to see, we also see the love between the Pandava brothers, which was a unifying force and helped them achieve victory. There's also the blind love that Dhritarashtra and Gandhari had for their children, which eventually led to their destruction. There's also the love between Krishna, the god, and Arjuna, the human. And it is this spiritual experience. Through these stories and more, we get to learn about the history, values, and traditions of the people of the time. But who are the Kauravas and Pandavas? And what is the Kuru dynasty? Kauravas and Pandavas belong to a line of rulers who are said to have descended from the deities related to Chandra or moon. And so their lineage is called the Chandravamsha or Luna dynasty. Some say that kings and princes of this dynasty have the energy from the moon, and that makes them more passionate and sensitive, a little bit emotional. That is the reason we see some intense stories. You know, they fight intensely, they hunt intensely, and they love intensely. Compare this with, say, rulers from the other major dynasty, the Suryavamsha or the Solar dynasty. They have the energy of the sun, and the kings and princes of this dynasty tend to be more stoic and reserved and responsible. Think Lord Rama. He belonged to the Suryavamsha. So the kings from this Chandravamsha have interesting stories, and they were very good rulers. Some of them include Buddha, Pururavas, Nahusha, Yayati, and many others. The Emperor Bharata is probably the most famous of them all, and so we'll start with him. Bharata was the descendant of Puru, who is the son of Yayati. So Puru and his four brothers started their own tribes or dynasties, and the Puru dynasty is the famous of them all. Under Puru dynasty, there was a clan named the Bharatas. And under the Bharatas, a very important battle was fought. This battle is called the Battle of the Ten Kings. The Bharatas won, and under them, several tribes unite, and they eventually form the Kuru dynasty. This battle is mentioned in the Rig Veda, and it is said to have taken place in the end of Rigvedic period. And that is how the Kuru dynasty was formed. The kingdom of Kuru included modern-day states of Haryana, Punjab, Delhi, and parts of western Uttar Pradesh. Their rule lasted from Middle Vedic period to Late Vedic period, that is between 1200 BCE and 500 BCE. The tribes practiced semi-nomadic pastoralism, agriculture, and trade, and the Kuru kings supplemented their income by raiding their neighbors, stealing cattle, and demanding bali or tribute. The Kuru kingdom was dominant during the rule of Parikshit and Janamejaya. They established the Kuru state, becoming the first such state in Indian history. They also majorly influenced the social and religious culture of the country, and their influences spread all over the country and lasts till date. For example, the Vedas were arranged into text under the Kuru rule, and a culture of caste system and Shrauta rituals, which are rituals based on the Vedas like yajnas and homas. These emerged during their rule as well. And we see these influences in our day-to-day life, even today. During the late Vedic period, the Kuru state declined and they eventually lost power. But thanks to the literature from the Vedic period, like the Mahabharata, their legacy still lives on, and their influences on the cultural traditions of India is undisputed. But what exactly happened with the Kauravas and Pandavas? Issues of illness and infertility plague the family, which leads to issues with regards to succession, which breeds resentment amongst the cousins, Kauravas and Pandavas. This leads to a final face-off in the Kurukshetra War, in which a large number of allies from both sides perished. Many involved belonged to the Luna dynasty. The Kauravas were completely destroyed, and very few on the Pandavas' side remained. In fact, only one heir was left in the Pandavas' side to continue the line. This was Arjuna's grandson and Abhimanyu's son, Parikshit. Parikshit's son, Janamejaya, was responsible for organizing the snake sacrifice. Now, this event happens after the Kurukshetra War, but it is told early on in the Mahabharata. Parikshit is killed by a Naga king named Takshaka. To avenge his death, his son Janamejaya organizes a snake sacrifice in which he planned to kill all those belonging to the Naga tribe. And it is in this snake sacrifice that he asks the bard to tell everyone gathered the story of the Jaya as told by Krishna Dvaipayana. And the bard tells everyone the story about the ancestors of the Kuru dynasty. And not only that, he also tells them the story of why Takshaka acted the way he did, why the relationship between some belonging to the Naga tribe and the Pandavas soured, and stories about why people acted the way they did, about right and wrong and dharma and other stories. We cannot talk about Mahabharata without talking about dharma, Bhagavad Gita, and Krishna. The main theme of the epic is the importance of upholding dharma or sacred duty above all else. The Pandava brothers, especially Arjuna and Yudhishthira, did not necessarily want to fight a war against their own kin. Arjuna struggled with this aspect a lot, and he expressed his reservations to Krishna. Krishna is his dear relative and friend. He is one of the main protagonists of the story. He is a kingmaker, a political philosopher, and a visionary. And in the Kurukshetra war, Krishna is Arjuna's counsel and charioteer. There is a dialogue that happens between Krishna and Arjuna, and this part is called the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna seeks answers about his duty as a Kshatriya, the morality of war, and various moral and ethical issues that humans face every day. Krishna answers him by talking about duty, dharma, different ways of approaching spirituality. They also talk about topics like self-realization. In short, it contains various philosophies and religious traditions that were being practiced during the time. For me, personally, the most beautiful thing about the Gita is that it is inclusive in the sense that it talks about various ways of approaching spirituality and life in general. It does not matter if you are a warrior, a trader, a businessman, or an employee. Everyone can achieve the same spiritual goals through different paths. The important thing is to not focus on the fruits of your action, but to focus on the action itself. And that is the message that the Bhagavad Gita talks about. Lastly, a note about the author and his connection to the Kurus. It is often said that the author of the Mahabharata is Vedavyasa, and that is not exactly accurate. We know that the author of the Mahabharata is the sage Krishna Dvaipayana. So who is this Vedavyasa? Vedavyasa is not a person. It is a title. Vyasa means to divide, and the title means the one who classified the Vedas. And there have been many other Vyasas in history, 28 in all. Krishna Dvaipayana Vedavyasa is definitely the most famous of them all. In fact, he is the only Vyasa I know of. And he was a very accomplished person. Not only did he author the Mahabharata and classify the Veda, he also authored 18 major Puranas and the Brahma Sutras. And he was also well connected. He is technically the grandfather of the Kaurava and Pandavas. He fathered their father, Dhritarashtra and Pandu, respectively. And he did this as per his mother Satyavati's request. Satyavati was married to the Kuru king Shantanu. So as you can see, Dvaipayana was very closely related to the Kurus. He makes multiple appearances in the story itself, where he helps out the Pandavas sometimes, and he's fondly referred to as grandfather. Dvaipayana essentially used the story of his own family to spread the divine message from the Veda. And he did it so beautifully. As the story progresses, you can see how the characters and situations are positioned in such a way as to include the divine wisdom from the ancient times. And you can see this especially in the case of Krishna and Arjuna, where Krishna is Narayana or God, and Arjuna is Nara, human. And through their stories, we get to explore the spiritual relationship between God, human, and self. So what is Mahabharata about? It is not just about war and dynastic politics, nor is it just about God, spirituality, and religion. It consists of religious, social, political, and spiritual ideas of the time. It talks about human relationships and feelings and how it can be both fragile and strong at the same time, how it can impact people around us and affect everyone. It talks about life as it is, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And yes, it is about good versus evil, but the good is not all good in the Mahabharata, and the bad is not all bad. Mahabharata identifies and acknowledges the nuances of life in general. An author once rightly said that Mahabharata is the portrait of humanity, and that is why I think it is the greatest story ever told, and that is why it remains relevant to this day. That is all I have for you today. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it, and I hope to see you here next time. I will also leave all the references for today's episode in the episode description. Thank you. Dhanyavada.